My name is Christian Ashley, a seminary student and servant of God, and you are listening to the Let Nothing Move You podcast, a proud Anazal Ministries podcast.
Welcome back, everyone, to the next episode of the Let Nothing Move You podcast. I'm your host, Christian Ashley. As we continue on through the book of Matthew, today we're going to be in chapter 17. But before we head that way, I do want to say thank you to everyone who sent out the birthday wishes. It's very appreciated. It was a very fun week I had with family and friends, and just got to enjoy, you know, the bounty that God has given me. And that's something to be reminded of, that I should be mindful of, is what I should say, more often than I do. And at the end of the day, I'm very grateful for what I do have. You know, there are places I'd rather be right now. There are things I'd rather be doing. And yet at the end of the day, God has me here, and I need to be content with that. I need to be prayerful about what he has me doing while I'm here versus where I see myself. And you know what? We're all in the process of learning. And I'm just grateful that he's patient. I'm grateful that he's loving and that he hasn't given up on me. So before we go any further in that, why don't we just go ahead and get into Matthew 17. We're going to start today in verses 1 through 13. And after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John, his brother, and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun, and his clothes became white as light. And behold, there appeared to them Moses and Elijah talking with him. And Peter said to Jesus, Lord, it is good that we are here. If you wish, I will make 3 tents here, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah. He was still speaking when, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and a voice from the cloud said, This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him. When the disciples heard this, they fell on their faces and were terrified. But Jesus came and touched them, saying, Rise and have no fear. And when they lifted up their eyes, they saw no one but Jesus only. And as they were coming down the mountain, Jesus commanded them, Tell no one the vision until the Son of Man is raised from the dead. And the disciples asked him, Then why do the scribes say that Elijah must come, that first Elijah must come? He answered, Elijah does come and he will restore all things. But I tell you that Elijah has already come, and they did not recognize him, but did to him whatever they pleased. So also the Son of Man will certainly suffer at their hands. Then the disciples understood that he was speaking to them of John the Baptist. So following the time of Jesus, you know, asking the disciples about who he really is, Peter giving the right answer, then 5 seconds later, Peter telling Jesus something he shouldn't be doing, and then being called Satan for it, and then Jesus teaching them about how it's time for them to take up their cross to follow him, he leads 3 of the 12 away. Now, why these three? Why Peter, James, and John? Well, because they were pretty much the inner circle. In a group, you're going to have people who are above other people, not because they're more important or better than them, but because, you know, they're more suited to leadership in that regard. And what Jesus was doing is he was preparing them by taking time separate from everyone else to invest in them, to make sure that they were as ready as possible, even though they weren't there yet, for them, when the time came for him to be gone, they would understand, oh, this is what this event meant. When Jesus ascends into heaven in the book of Acts, after he's given the Great Commission at the end of this book, they're going to know and say, this is what he was talking about. We're not supposed to reveal to the others until now, and they can tell them, look, we saw the kingdom of heaven starting right here. And I am of the belief that this is where the kingdom of heaven starts. I could be wrong. It could be after, you know, Jesus, you know, raises from the grave. It could even be when he dies. But I'm not one of those people to say that the kingdom of heaven is not on this earth. I vehemently disagree with that idea, because the kingdom is every Christian who exists, regardless of location, regardless of tribe or tongue, and the active work that they are doing in ministry, whether they're having to do it in secret or can boldly do it as I am doing right now. That's the kingdom. And the kingdom is shown to everyone. Oh, shown to these three right here. Sorry, let me say that again. After Jesus had talked about it previously being a thing that they need to know, but also as a means of for them to start to understand who he really is. They've been with him for however many years. They've heard him preach. They've seen the miracles. They've heard what he said about himself. But now these three out of the 12 get something special. They get to witness the fullness of Jesus Christ as revealed to them through the transfiguration. Now, scholars have debated over many years whether or not Jesus physically changed his appearance forever after this certain point in time, or if this was a temporary thing for them to see. We don't truly know. I will say I'm on the more temporarily. They saw the fullness of who he is, that he kept away under the form of man and God to show them the more God part of himself, the 100% God and 100% man that he was. He's showing the 100% God in a way that didn't, you know, break their minds or anything like that. But there are debates against that. I'm not going to say one way or the other whether you're right on that. Because at the end of the day, what matters here is what Jesus is trying to teach them and us, and how they and us, how we respond to it. This is earth-shattering. We lose some of the context because we are not Jewish. It's not our fault. Except for the fact when people aren't being taught well. That's a separate issue. But from a cultural Jewish context here, this is immensely important. We see pretty much the personification of the law and the prophets submitting to Jesus here. Moses as the author of the law. Yes, God, of course, was the ultimate author, but Moses was the one who wrote it down for the people. Then we have Elijah, who is pretty much the greatest of the prophets, to the point where at the end of the book of Malachi, when he's saying Elijah will come back to you, that's because all the Jewish people saw him as like the greatest of the great. You know, they weren't expecting Ezekiel to come back, or they weren't expecting Zechariah to come back. They were expecting Elijah to come back because of his boldness of faith, because of the hard work that he had done alongside God in bringing some people to some saving faith in the midst of the oppression of the cult of Baal that King Ahab and Queen Jezebel were enacting in the northern kingdom of Israel. And he, of course, is also one of only two people to have ever never died. The other, of course, being Enoch, and we discussed him a little bit back in Genesis. But the important part here isn't the feats. It's what is the expectation of the Jewish people. And Jesus is showing that these two men who embody these aspects, I said personification of them, and I kind of almost mean that literally, in that they're not literally, you know, the text or the preaching, the prophesying, but they are the embodiment of both for the people in the fact of what they represent, in the fact of what they've done, in the fact of hundreds of years later, the Jewish people are still being impacted by them. So for them to talk to Jesus and be seen as lesser than him shows something. He's better than them. That they don't fully get it yet, but they get a little closer here because Peter, being Peter, starts off putting his foot in his mouth, saying, hey, we'll make tents for all of you. You know, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah. He's thinking, oh man, Jesus loves me already. But could you imagine if I tell everyone else, oh, I made a tent for Moses and Elijah. Don't you think God favors me more than you idiots? It's not explicitly said in the text, but knowing Peter as we do, you can definitely feel there's a little bit of that that pride and arrogance seeping in, thinking, ha-ha, I'm going to stake my claim here. I'm going to be better than James and John. I'm going to be better than the other nine disciples. I'm going to be better than the other followers of Jesus. But what does Jesus do with them? For the moment, nothing, because the Father speaks first. An answer to Peter's suggestion. He points figuratively to Jesus, says, this is my beloved son with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him. And upon hearing the voice of God, what do the disciples do? The smart thing. They get down on their hands and knees in fear and trembling because God is directly speaking to them. And you know what? That should be our response too. To an extent. God speaks to us. God will speak to us in some way, shape, or form. It could be through a suggestion that comes popping in our mind, or we could literally hear him. Or it could be through someone in their lives speaking the truth that God has given them. Either way, we should be in awe and show reverence to what is being told to us. Whether it's a whisper, whether it's a loud booming voice, whether it's someone in our lives who's been praying and they have the answer for us to the question we didn't even ask. There should be a reverence to that. And so they get down on their faces, terrified. But they don't remain there, because this is when Jesus speaks up. And he even touches them. They look, rise and have no fear. And when they're able to do so, to see that Jesus is the only one left. Because Moses and Elijah served their role. They're not as important as Jesus is. They've seen the fulfillment of the Old Testament. Everything that Moses and Elijah worked for is right in front of them in Jesus Christ. Every hardship they endured, every plague, every disaster, every time of fear and wanting to die means nothing. Now that they have the certainty. The work they did meant something because it led to this moment. And the disciples almost get it. They're so very close. They recognize, wait, oh, this is saying something special about Jesus. But also to curb them, because he knows who they are, know they're kind of gossipy hens. Jesus tells them not to tell anyone until the Son of Man is raised from the dead. This is still a time when they don't believe that's going to be a thing. They don't understand that Jesus has to die, even though he said it multiple times. But they're going to listen. But they're also confused, because as has been preached for 400 some years, before the Messiah comes, Elijah is going to return. And so that we also lose a bit of context there, you know, being Gentiles, for the most part of my listening audience, I'm fairly certain. And that this isn't taught to us because, well, we've already had the Messiah come. But for them, this is a huge part of their desire, their wanting, their adoration for God is knowing that God is going to send Elijah again, heralding the Messiah. But Jesus, even though they should already know the answer, helps them figure it out. Elijah already came, but they didn't recognize him. And they did whatever they pleased to him, i.e. they murdered him. Just as he suffered, the Son of Man will certainly suffer. And they understand the first part, that he was talking of John the Baptist. But they don't explicitly understand the second part yet. Now we can get frustrated with him. We can say, can't you idiots understand what Jesus is saying? But Jesus chooses not to focus on that. He knows they don't get it. But he is pleased with them in that they got something out of this. And he also knows that these three men, when the time comes after the crucifixion, are going to do extraordinary things, and they're going to recall this story to their fellow disciples, to the fellow believers, and they're going to understand it too, because the timing is going to be right then. It's not right now for them to speak. But later on, when the time is right, they'll be able to say everything they need to. It's going to enrich the body, and it enriches us. Because, yes, even though we are far removed from these events, yes, we were not raised to understand rabbinical law, we still get to reap the benefits of this and go, oh, you mean when I read the Old Testament, like we did with the Pentateuch and like we'll do with the historical books and then the book of prophecies, the prophetical books, that this was all leading up to this? Yes! The Old Testament is not some obsolete thing that doesn't matter to you and I. The Old Testament is still as living and breathing as it was back in their time. So let us embrace it. Let us reject anyone who says we no longer need it, because without it, we don't have the prophecies. We don't have the law to show us that we'll never be good enough, to show us that God was promising that he would bring a Messiah to the world. All the way back in Genesis, from our first parents, he promised this. So that's why we need to study it, so that when events like this happen, I'm not saying they'll exactly happen like this, but when special events happen in our lives, we go, wait a minute, this is what God was preparing me for. And go, oh, that's why I read that book. That's why I read about that law. That's why I read about that prophet. And you'll be surprised. Very, very surprised how relevant it suddenly becomes from that supposedly old dusty tome of the Old Testament that has no relevance in a modern life. You'll hear the world say, it's outdated. It's not loving. It's hateful. It's spiteful. It's evil. It's not, has nothing to do with Jesus. Jesus got rid of it. He abolished it. That's the exact opposite of what he said. He came to fulfill it. And they're seeing fulfillment of prophecy right before their very eyes. But so were other people around Jesus. Now, obviously, they didn't see the transfiguration, but they've seen other prophecies fulfilled in front of their eyes. The blind healed. They can see. The deaf hear. Demons are cast out. Wisdom is being spoken to the people. Truth is being spoken to the people. God is redeeming his own. He's forgiving the sins of men for the many evils that they've done. And yet they don't fall down on their faces in fear, in trembling. May it never be said of us that we failed to respond correctly. May it never be said of me. If I'm doing an honest assessment of myself, yeah, absolutely. It should have been said of me multiple times over. But I don't want that to be the truth. I want to move beyond that. May it never be said of me again. May I fall down on my face in fear and trembling, terrified, knowing that I'm with the Savior, and yet at that same time being comforted, being raised up, having the fear removed from me to show he is love, show that he's in charge, he's sovereign, and he has a plan for me and others. And that's a very difficult thing to do right now in the midst of the in-between, in the midst of not knowing where to go from here, what to do. You know, am I wasting my time sending out this application here? Am I wasting my time serving here? How could I use my time better? You know, what do I need to work on? All the fear and uncertainty that comes from something like that, and I'm sure you guys have had multiple instances of your lives of something, if not similar, but something else that brought those anxieties to you. Like, look, let me tell you, I don't like being in the midst of the in-between. I don't like being in the midst of not understanding. But I do know that I could make it worse for myself if I waste my time in the middle of the not understanding. If I don't spend time praying, if I don't spend time reading the word, if I don't spend time serving. Yeah, I have a lack of clarity on where I'm supposed to be, but why not help other people while I'm here? Because my intent when I find the ultimate goal of the job is to help other people. So why not do it now? Why not love them well now by serving? By looking out for them, by praying for them, by being the ear they need to just talk to, spend time with, rather than just being the misanthropic, loner kind of person that I am, little hermit. I could be doing something more productive. And yeah, I am doing something. I'm working with the youth at our church right now. I've gotten involved with a small group at church. I'm reminding myself that I can't just stay here forever in the midst of this melancholy of not understanding things. And look, it's hard. It's going to be rough. It's not fun, but it's worth doing. It's worth being in the middle of the in-between because eventually, you know, because that's how lines work. There's going to be another side of this. There's going to be an end to the line at the in-between. I'm going to find the answer. And you're going to find the answer too. We just have to trust him. And know that just because he hasn't revealed the information to us now doesn't mean he doesn't love us. He didn't reveal this information to the other disciples. He had Peter, James, and John do that afterward because it was time. So let us trust him that his time is correct. And let us submit to it. And we'll go on from there to verses 14 through 21. Now, when they came to the crowd, a man came up to him and kneeling before him said, Lord, have mercy on my son, for he has seizures and he suffers terribly. He often falls into the fire and often into the water. And I brought him to your disciples and they could not heal him. And Jesus answered, O faithless and twisted generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him here to me. And Jesus rebuked the demon, and it came out of him, and the boy was healed instantly. Then the disciples came to Jesus privately and said, Why could we not cast it out? He said to them, Because of your little faith. For truly I say to you, if you have faith like a grain of mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, Move from here to there, and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you. Now, some of you may be saying, Christian, you're missing a verse there. And hold on. I said 21. That is not in my edition as ESV that I have as far as being written inside the text. There's a little note that says some manuscripts insert verse 21, but this kind never comes out except by prayer and fasting. And we'll get to that when we get to that. Well, let's start at the beginning. We see a father in need. Now, like the Syrophoenician woman, like many others before, there is a physical and spiritual need that is not being met. There's peril being brought to a family member. And what does he do? He goes and seeks out help. However, the first people he goes to fail. The disciples fail at their job, something that they previously had been able to do. Why would it? Was their faith somehow lesser after spending more time with Jesus? No. They had learned more, but they were in a different period of life. There had been a certain complacency that had wrapped around their hearts, a certain assuredness that, oh, we serve the real master of the real God. We can do whatever we want. There's some arrogance that came in with that. And that arrogance clouded faith. And it clouded truth. And they weren't able to perform as they did beforehand. But the father doesn't give up. Now, surely you would think, well, if his students can't do it, he can't either because he sucks as a teacher. But that's the wrong way of thinking. And he proves himself a little better than some people who would think that way. When he goes directly to Jesus and said, look, your disciples couldn't do it. Let me explain the situation to you. Help me out. And what does Jesus do? He rebukes his disciples. Oh, faithless and twisted generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? He said, look, I love you, but you don't get it. You're too wrapped up in yourselves. And you know how he can say that? Because in the next chapter, they're going to be talking about which one of them's the best of the best. Who's the greatest? We're not there yet. But clearly, that's in their hearts, and that's clearly part of the problem here. And I'm thinking, they're better. They're superior. We're disciples of the Messiah. We're going to be honored and glorified in the new kingdom that he's bringing, not knowing that part of being honored is going to be persecution. It's going to be experiencing times of doubt and fear and unbelief. It's going to be times of pain and suffering. They're thinking they're going to be on the top. They're going to be the best of the best. They'll be advisors, students, leaders, serving under the Messiah. And the people will be looking up to them saying, praise you for being among the best, for knowing who Jesus was before we did. And that pride and arrogance twisted around their brain, their heart, to make them useless. So Jesus calls them out, faithless and twisted generation. And unfortunately, this is very true of certain people in the church today. people who are saved. And yet at the end of the day, end up where the disciples did, because they focus on self and glorifying themselves and showing off their prestige and their accomplishments and their accreditations or whatever. And it makes their witness falter. It makes their ability to do their job weaken. It harms those that they think that they're helping because they don't do it with their full hearts. They don't do it with hearts of submission and humbleness. They do it out of hearts of arrogance, ego, pride. Then look at me, look at me, look at me. Rather than no, don't look at me, look at him, look at him, look at him. And no wonder Jesus gets so angry with them. He expects this out of the Pharisees because they're foolish. They're unwise. They're only wise by their own acceptance of the idea of what wisdom is. But the disciples know better. They've done this before. They had faith. They saw people saved from this. Lives changed. And yet here we are now, and they can't get rid of one simple demon. How do you think you're going to lead the church? How do you think you're going to lead people to know me if you can't even do this simple thing? And yes, exorcism, true exorcism, is a simple thing. You tell the demon, get out. And if you're his, and if your heart is right, game, set, match. There is no extra 45 minutes left to the movie. It is anticlimactic. The demon leaves. And yet they can't even do this simple thing. So how could they ever think they'd do the more difficult thing of leading a church and leading the people to Jesus? No wonder he's so angry with them. He knows he's not going to be there forever. He also knows that they're going to get there. But part of them getting there is him being harsh with them. Is him not babying them. Saying, oh, you'll get it, my precious little sweeties. Oh, one day, you're in rebellion right now. You don't get it, but you'll get there. Say, no, shape up, buck up, man up, do your job. Know what you're supposed to be doing. Quit relying on yourself. Rely on me. And what does he do? To showcase his authority once more? To show them how things are supposed to be done? He goes to the boy. Talks to the demon that's possessing him. Tells it to get out. And it does. The boy was healed a couple days from now. No, a week from now, a month from now. No, the boy was healed instantly. Because Jesus had faith. Because Jesus knew truth. Because Jesus knew it was about him. And submission to the Father. So it just got done. And you know what? That's how things are supposed to get done. We're supposed to get things done because we know truth. Because we know who we work for. We know that we're not number one. Then in submission, we say, yes, Lord, let's do this. And then things, for the most part, get done. Yeah, there are things in this world that get in the way of truth, that get in the way of projects, that get in the way of us being able to serve others. Sure. But let us not be the stepping stone or the hurdle that we have to jump over. Or the brick wall in our path. No, let us be the one who makes it easier for everyone else by removing those obstacles from the course. I meant stumbling stone, not stepping stone. Oh, well. So what do the disciples do? Well, they ask a genuine question. Like, why couldn't we do it? And Jesus, rebuking them still, tells them, because of your little faith. And this is where we get the great verse about the mustard seed and the faith of being able to move a mountain. If we tell it to move, nothing will be impossible for you. Now, we have to be very careful with what's being said here, because people can twist this and say, okay, prove your faith then. Make me a believer today. Or move this building over here to somewhere else. Or turn water into wine. Nothing should be impossible for you. Foolishness. Foolishness. What Jesus is talking about, nothing will be impossible for you when you work for the kingdom. When you're doing the work I tell you to do, nothing will be impossible for you. When you're doing the things I'm telling you to do, mountains are going to move. Lives are going to be changed. Hearts are going to be changed. that you thought couldn't be done. But because you submitted, because you did the work, hearts were changed. Cities are healed. Lives are saved eternally. Because you did what you were supposed to do, because you had faith. And you got to start with that mustard seed idea of it has to start off small. You're just getting to it. And you go, I don't understand everything. Well, guess what? You don't have to understand everything off the bat. But part of that faith is growing. It's asking questions. It's reaching out and saying, please help me understand this. I don't get it. Why is that verse omitted? Like, it's in my Bible. Why is it in yours? Well, let me tell you. Because it wasn't in the earliest manuscripts, if I'm remembering correctly. This is something that is inserted in other copies that we have, later copies of the Gospels, of the Gospel of Matthew. And that is something I had to wrestle with a lot when I was in seminary, because normally I would have just preached from that and gone on with my day. But I was challenged by my New Testament professor and a couple of others who said, no, I would never teach a verse like that one. It wasn't in the original manuscript. It wasn't written by Matthew. And I go, huh. You know, I intellectually, I knew that. Logically, I knew that. But it didn't click with me until it was said. Oh, yeah, Matthew didn't write that. Someone else did years after the fact. That doesn't belong there. Maybe this is even spiritually true, that you need to pray and fast, you know, to move out a demon. I don't see the logic behind it because nowhere else in Scripture is that apparent. But I can't in good faith tell the people that I'm talking to right now, you should believe what this has to say, this inspired Scripture, when clearly it isn't. It's not in the original manuscript. Maybe if Matthew, if he published a second edition later on, sure. That's one thing, but he didn't, because it would still be inspired because he's the one who was told to write it down. But that didn't happen. Someone else, probably well-meaning, probably someone who had full faith in God and thought, well, maybe I'll explain it a little better if I add this in there, not knowing that they were causing problems. Maybe that's naive of me to say. Maybe someone did it maliciously to mislead others. I don't know. I don't know who it was. I know it's not Matthew. And therefore, because it's not him, it's not inspired. So I do not preach from it. And that'll be a little more apparent when we do get to Mark and John, as there are certain sections there that weren't in the original text. And I'm going to mention them. I'm not going to preach them, because they weren't in the original manuscript, because they're not inspired. And that's something you have to ask yourself as you're growing in your faith, as you're growing from that mustard seed of Scripture is good. Scripture is something I should be learning from. Good. Great starting point. I'm 100% behind you. But you have to have discernment. And that's part of maturity. That's part of growing in faith. And not just blindly accepting what's on the page. Well, how am I to trust that Matthew wrote this? Well, let us look at the history. Let us look at the artifacts of translations that we have of the book of Matthew. Where are the earliest ones from? Who's talking about it? And we go to the early history of the church fathers and how they quote from it. Not even 100 years removed from the original date of publication. And yeah, part of that is stepping out in faith and knowing, well, Matthew isn't here. We don't have the number one original document. We do not. Unless it's hidden somewhere, it's highly unlikely. It's probably lost literally to the sands of time. It's probably dust. So there's something to be said about stepping out in faith, knowing that, well, we don't have the original document, and yet I still believe this to be true. I can't prove it's the original 100% document. So what am I supposed to do with that? You have to judge it by itself and by the other editions that we have and by what the church fathers said. And with the discernment that God has gifted us, we have to make a response. And some people are going to give the wrong one. They're going to say, well, it doesn't matter. Someone else put it in. God just puts other stuff in other editions later on. He did it with the temple back in the day after the exile, you know, versus no, it being written by the original authors and then later on being compiled, written down by priests and the like, and scribes, not edited, not changed for their sake. So we can get wild ideas about truth, and we get lost in the weeds. And that's not where Jesus wants to go. Yeah, I've kind of gone on the rabbit trail, but it's something that I need us to focus on, because I know there's going to be questions out there. Why didn't he mention 21? He said he was going to 21. This is why. It's not in the original manuscript. I don't preach from it. So let us be mindful of that. Let us not lose focus. Let us return to what Jesus says. Have the faith of a grain of mustard seed. Tell the mountain to move from here to there, and it will. And nothing will be impossible for you when you work for the kingdom. Yeah, those words aren't written down there, but they fit everything else Jesus has said. Through faith is working in the kingdom. It's looking out for others. It's emboldening them with scripture. It's emboldening them with truth so that they can go out and do the same. Because when we don't have this faith, even in the mustard seed, any demons we come away, whether they be literal spiritual demons or the antagonistic forces that are in our lives, we're not going to be prepared for them, and they're going to overwhelm us, and we're going to fail. So we can't afford to do that. So let it not be said of us. Let us submit. Let us have that faith of a mustard seed, because what it does is it grows. It cultivates, becomes larger and mightier, and serves a useful purpose that brings life. So let us go out and do the same. And we'll go next to 22 and 23. As they were gathering in Galilee, Jesus said to them, "The Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and he will be raised on the third day." And they were greatly distressed. This is the second time, at least that is recorded to us. He probably said it other times, where Jesus said, "Hey, I'm going to die, and I'm going to come back on the third day." And what is their response after being told, "Hey, have the faith of a mustard seed?" "Oh, no. What does he mean he's going to die?" They focus on the wrong part. They get distressed. He thinks he's going to become a martyr. "We can't let the Messiah, can't that happen to you? You have to lead us. You have to beat the Romans. Lord, why are you doing this? Jesus, why?" And they panic because their faith is small, almost non-existent. And they also panic because we've got some new information here. Jesus is going to be betrayed. He's going to be delivered into the hands of men, which implies someone has to be the one to deliver him. Now, of course, we know that this is Judas, but they don't understand. So now they're, who's going to betray him? What's going on here? I don't understand, Jesus. Well, you would if you paid attention, if you actually listened with discernment. So let us learn from their example and go, oh, why am I panicking? New information has been presented to me, and it's a distressing thing that I just heard. Do I panic and end up useless and unhelpful? Or do I go, okay, let's logically assess everything. So, okay, this has happened. What do I need to do in response to it? I'm upset. I don't want this to be happening. And yet, in order to be useful, in order to love people well, let me go out and do this. Or if I can't do it, send out someone who can. Or if I don't understand what the information being presented to me, go to someone who can. So we can strengthen each other. They talk amongst each other, and all they do is bring each other down because they don't understand. Rather than going, "Jesus, what do you mean? Help us." They end up in distress, even though they have the ultimate source of all knowledge right in front of them. They could literally ask him anything. And maybe there were times they asked Jesus questions that we would have liked to ask him, you know, about nature, about the world, about our place in it, or something like that. And yet we don't see them using the one holy, perfect resource as much as they should. All they had to do was go to him for understanding. And yet they panic because they're not there yet. So let us not emulate them. Let us excise those ideas from ourselves and go, my natural inclination is to panic. My natural inclination is to get angry. My natural inclination is to be confused. Well, that's natural. You know what's unnatural? Wisdom. What's unnatural? Learning. What's unnatural? Not acting like you're a member of this world. So let us come out and do that. Let us be unnatural. Let us not be distressed by the things in this world. Let us find comfort in the one who brings comfort and understanding and peace. And let's also finish off today by going through verses 24 through 27. When they came to Capernaum, the collectors of the 2 drachma tax went up to Peter and said, "Does your teacher not pay the tax?" He said, "Yes." And when he came into the house, Jesus spoke to him first, saying, "What do you think, Simon? From whom do kings of the earth take toll or tax? From their sons or from others?" And when he said, "From others," Jesus said to him, "Then the sons are free. However, not to give offense to them, go to the sea and cast a hook and take the first fish that comes up. And when you open its mouth, you will find a shekel. Take that and give it to them for me and for yourself." So Peter, on his own, a dangerous place for a very impetuous person like him to be. Maybe you're like them. They test him. And Peter fails, as Peter's wont to do right now. He gets better, I promise. But this is part of, if you'll remember from our time in the books of the Pentateuch, the census tax that was done that everyone had to do, because if you were a member of Israel, you had to give money to the temple. And in addition to that, you also had the census tax that was a special time of making sure that things were done and people could be cared for, taken from the money here. And they ask him, "What does Jesus think that he's above this? Because God told us to do it," is the implication. And Peter says, no, he doesn't pay the tax. He shouldn't have to. And he fails the test. And Jesus uses this as a teachable moment. Because eventually, this is going to be done away with. As part of the fulfillment of the law, this is no longer necessary. But since they're still in a time where this has not been fulfilled yet, what does Jesus do? He says there's going to be a time when it's not applicable, because, hey, who do kings take money from? Their sons, the members of their own family, or from others? And he said, Peter rightly says others. Yeah, that's how it's going to be. But right here and now, that hasn't been abolished yet. That hasn't been fulfilled yet, is what I should say. So let us submit to it. So when the time comes and it's no longer applicable, when people ask, "Did you do what you were supposed to do then?" we can say, "Yes." So not only that, they're asking for a 2 drachma tax. Well, Peter, go out, get a hook, get the first fish that comes out. There's going to be a shekel. You know what that means? A shekel is about 4 drachma worth. So that means by bringing them the shekel, Peter is paying for himself and Jesus, which shows that Jesus shows submission to the laws of God, even though those that aren't moral, because at this point in time, they're supposed to be followed. But there is a day coming when they won't matter anymore. They're fulfilled. There is no reason to use this tax because the temple doesn't matter. Because the presence of God is given to the world rather than being holed up in Jerusalem. We are all going to be sons of the Father, all those who were his. So why would God tax his own sons? And Peter, of course, doesn't truly understand it yet, but what does he do? Does he whine? Does he complain? No, he does what Jesus tells him to do. Good job, Peter. And that's something that we can all learn from, even when we whine and complain. Even when we get things wrong, well, God says to do something, we don't originally do it, and he says to do it again, what do? Or if we misrepresent him, screw things up, and give people a poor impression of him, what do? We submit to him and we make up for what we did. And Peter does that. Look, praise the good, curse the evil, love them despite themselves. Because if we give up on Peter now, we don't have the Peter of Acts. We don't have the Peter of 1st and 2nd Peter. So let us not do the same for those around us who don't understand yet. Help them to understand. Jesus doesn't say, Peter, you're an idiot, you're a moron, shut up, I'll figure it out myself. No, he says, Peter, let me help you understand. So that later on you're going to get, oh, that's what Jesus meant. Let me help you understand a little bit now, and then later on you'll get even more. Because I'm a good shepherd, because I'm a good teacher, let me help you. And that is what we are supposed to do, to be the good shepherd, to be the good teacher. Yeah, not everyone's going to be a pastor. Not everyone's going to be a small group leader or what have you. But you know what? We're still supposed to teach people. We're still supposed to love them. We're supposed to shepherd them well, the people that God has put in our lives. Who else is going to protect them? Who else is going to love them enough to teach them truth and wisdom? The world isn't, because the world knows nothing of wisdom. The world knows nothing of love. It knows nothing of truth. So let's do what we're supposed to do. Let us love well. And let us learn from our mistakes and intentional choices. Because there's a big difference between the two. I screw up every now and then because I wasn't thinking clearly. And there are other times I screw up because I intentionally did something sinful because that's what I wanted to do. And yet I have to make up for that. I have to ask for forgiveness. Just as much as when I screw up not on purpose and when I screw up on purpose. So let that be another little free lesson there. And that, of course, will conclude our show today. Thank you guys for all that you do. Please do get a chance to give a 5-star review on your podcasting platform of choice. Help us with the ratings there to help us find more people. Feel free to share the show with friends and family members. If you're interested in my own fiction writing, you can find my work at starvingwritersguild.com or on Amazon by searching for the name MC Ashley. If you're all interested in some further solid studies into the Bible and its teachings, then check out the other members of the Anison Ministry Podcasting Network. You can find me specifically on Systematic Ecology, Why I Don't Like, Friday Night Frights, and Some Joyful Noises. You can contact me at letnothingmoviepodcast@gmail.com. I'd like to extend a special thank you to Joshua Knoll for the editing that he does and for the music he has to the podcast. And with all that in mind, God bless you all in accordance to his will, not mine. Allow me one more time to remind you, let nothing move you.